Hey everyone, Fred DeLore here, welcoming you to what is going to be an extraordinary episode of On Background. Like most of our episodes, this one is going to be about storytelling, reflection, and a bit of political nostalgia. We're casting our minds back to the 2015 battle for Central Nova, a significant chapter in both my life and that of my guest today. I want to emphasize that this isn't just any political reminiscence. In 2015, I was a candidate in this very battle, standing for election in Central Nova and facing off against a formidable opponent. It was a campaign that tested every fiber of my being, and though it didn't end in victory for me, it was a journey filled with invaluable experiences and lessons. The significance of today's episode is magnified by the presence of Sean Fraser. To those of you who may not recall the specifics, Sean was my opponent in that race, and he emerged as the victor and since then has gone on to carve out a remarkable career for himself in Canadian politics, contributing profoundly as a senior cabinet minister in this Liberal government. Having Sean here today is a testament to the respect and camaraderie that can exist beyond the heat of political competition. It's a rare and cool opportunity to bring together two sides of a story, nearly a decade later, to share the behind-the-scenes moments, the challenges, and the triumphs of that campaign. So, without further ado, let's dive into this unique dialogue. Sean, it's a pleasure to have you with us, sharing insights and reflections from our shared history in Central Nova, from the perspective of someone who has continued to make significant strides in public service.
Thanks so much. It's good to be with you. Looking forward to the chat.
And look, I want to kick things off by obviously expressing my deep gratitude for taking the time to join us today. I know your schedule's jam-packed and you're constantly on the move with your responsibilities, so I really appreciate you taking the time out of your evening to join us here. And tonight, I hope we have a fun chat going down memory lane for that epic battle. At least it was epic in my eyes. That sent us on two very different paths that we'll talk about at the end as well. So with that, let's set the table here a bit. It's spring 2015. My Conservative Party has a candidate, Peter MacKay. Your Liberal Party has a candidate in David MacLeod. Almost within a day of each other, they both pull out of the race. They both decide for different reasons not to run. Where were you? You were in Calgary at the time practicing law. Where, like, when you found out this news, I'm very curious to what spurred you on to go home to run.
I remember it like it was yesterday and clear as day. So I was living in Calgary at the time practicing law, but at the moment when this happened, one of my best friends was getting married outside of Toronto, and my wife and I were driving from Pearson to the wedding venue, and during the car ride, it might have been half an hour apart, we heard the announcement that both the Liberal candidate and Peter MacKay were stepping aside, which nobody had been expecting, and of course, with an October election, it was right around the corner. I was happy doing what I was going to do. My wife and I talked about planning to move home, but maybe not for a couple more years. And when I got to the wedding venue, a bunch of guys from home who were involved in the community, who were inclined to support our party, said, Sean, look, if there was ever a time, this is a good opportunity. I should say as well, one of them was a dear friend of mine and volunteer, Ray Wegg, who just passed away a number of weeks ago, one of our top volunteers, the main fundraiser for our party at home. And if it weren't for those conversations, who knows what life path I would have been on. But that was a pretty important few days in my life.
It's amazing, yeah, if you weren't at that wedding and didn't have those people around you to encourage, who knows what would have happened there.
Yeah, the conversations along the way can really set you down a different path. Now, look, I'd like to think I would have become aware of the opportunity and having thought about when, not if, I was going to get back home, would have realized the opportunity on my own. But I know what might have happened, and I know what did happen.
Right.
And if it weren't for that that pushing and prodding from a few folks who cared about our community who happened to be there that weekend, you can never really say with certainty.
Right. For me, it was I was actually setting up the war room for the 2015 general election, and Jenny Byrne came into my office to tell me Peter's getting out, and the Prime Minister's heading down to be a part of his goodbye send-off. And she had always known that I was interested in doing it. Go back to like 2008 or 9, Peter was looking to become General Secretary of NATO. He was trying to put a campaign together for that. So there was chatter then. I was at the Prime Minister's office then about taking a stab at it. So it was always on my mind as well. So when this opened up, it was like one of those things like, well, this is the time as well. This is, you know, a safe Conservative seat, as you've heard lots, I'm sure. So yeah, let's go do it. So that's what set me on my path. So for you, how long before you got back there to do it? Like, you had to go back to Calgary, get things in order. What was the?
Yeah, so it was. It happened to be the weekend of my 31st birthday. Was when my pal got married. So I remember the timing fairly well because I think our nomination, if memory serves, was July 18th or roughly thereabouts.
You would know better. I kind of forgot about a lot of those dates.
Yeah, yeah.
when you lose, you kind of
drift
away.
Right. Yeah, I wish I was keeping a journal, but no, I'm going from memory. But I remember it was about when I first thought about the opportunity, and between then and my nomination was a total of about 6 weeks. So I went back to Calgary, talked to my work about what I was thinking about doing, and they were great to me. They said, look, if it's 6 weeks or 6 years, you'll always have a home here. That it was nice to have that sort of comfort. But the deal we made was take a leave of absence, figure out whether you're actually the candidate. If it needs to go beyond that, let's talk about how you're going to move on from the firm. Right. Within a couple of weeks, I'd filled out the forms and was calling everybody who had a Liberal membership and trying to sell them to everyone I knew. So it was an interesting time.
Yeah. So I was director of political operations for the Conservative Party at the time. So for me to run in a nomination, I had to resign mm-hmm. fully from my position. So I went 6 months, obviously hoping I'd get a better job out of it, and that didn't work out. But different situation there, but same idea, going home and just starts working the phones, right? Mm-hmm. I was back there quickly, selling memberships, and it was tough. And now my nomination, I was nominated on Saturday. You were nominated the next day on Sunday, if my memory is correct on that.
And the NDP nomination was the same weekend.
It
was,
oh, really?
There was a lot happening simultaneously. I remember one of the reporters with the Herald at the time, Andrea Gunn, showed up at ours and heard there was a decent crowd at the NDP's. So she actually left midway through and came back and said, why is the parking lot so full? What did I miss? And it was all one weekend, though.
Right. And it's interesting, the NDP, if you looked at the last number of elections, the NDP were the second place party there, right? Your party was the third party.
Yeah.
And well, provincially as well, you guys were really weak in Central Nova.
Yeah. Look, we in my lifetime, there has been one federal election in 93 when we swept the province, and one provincial election in my part of the federal riding of Pictou County that was actually a by-election when Donald Cameron stepped down, and it was a protest vote. So we don't have a long history. The guy before Roseanne Skok, who last won for us, I think he was born in 1870.
Wow.
So this is not a hotbed of liberalism at
safe
home.
Safe Tory seat.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It was a fascinating thing, but it was not necessarily a place where the brand got a lot of traction. We typically didn't finish first or second. And in fact, in 2008, Elizabeth May ran in the riding, and there was an agreement reached where we didn't run a candidate. And since then, there was limited party infrastructure because the volunteers didn't feel that they had the support of the party infrastructure for a number of cycles. And it wasn't until 2015 they really got back together in an organized way.
Did you have an opponent in the nomination? Was it a contested?
It was, yeah. It was a woman who's a friend and great supporter, Janet Baskinall from Antigonish. She's plugged into the community in Antigonish. A lovely person, but it helped grow the membership because we would have had, at the previous nomination, a few months before, you'd mentioned there'd been a prior candidate.
Right.
I think they had about 114 members is what I heard. And we had to do it real quick in a number of weeks. And I think we had at Summer Street Industries, somebody said 700. I would say probably more like 500 people showed up.
Okay.
But it was significant growth because there was a contested nomination.
And I think that I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think we had around 300 or 400. And if you consider when Peter McKay ran for the nomination 18 years prior, there was like, I think, 3,000 or 4,000. So it was certainly something was happening.
Yeah,
in Tory Lahan.
Well, it's funny. I forgot about that until now, but I remember it was a huge point of pride on the day of the nomination because somebody came to realize we had become the party that had more registered members for the first time in anyone's living memory. And it created a little bit of swagger and confidence with the team that, we might actually be able to do something here. And it was a neat feeling.
Yeah, I remember seeing the visuals from your nomination, watching it closely and seeing you guys had a lot of people. So we really had to hit the ground running. But I felt you hit the ground faster. You had signs up quick. Ours were slow to come in. I don't know what exactly what it was. Like, just building the team was at a different pace. How did you feel back then, if you recall it?
Yeah, it was neat. I remember.
I should preface, you've done this now twice since this election.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'm asking to, I remember one, you've got three to think through.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating thing because we have built up a stronger organization, but what we lacked in organization, we had an enthusiasm for the first time. There was a real belief that we could actually win.
Yeah.
And I don't know what inspired it, but through the nomination process, when we saw people getting fired up, we had a few people sort of coach the team in the weeks leading up to it on how to run a proper one with actually calling people and confirming they would show up. Like, some of the very basic things was brand new to us.
Right.
But I remember the day after the nomination, we met with the board of the EDA, and I think we had $7,800 in the bank. And
wow, that's all you guys had.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, Ray Wegg, who I mentioned, my friend who passed away, over the course of that campaign, I understand we became the best fundraising riding association in Atlantic Canada with about $135,000.
Right.
For a small town campaign, that's a lot of money to come in.
You outspent me by $4,000, I think. I looked it up.
Oh, right on.
And I, of course, I had the benefit of Peter McKay's riding, so the bank can't. The account was already full for me. I didn't have to fundraise.
That's right. But it felt, obviously, with the benefit of hindsight, it was a change election, and people felt motivated. And the trick was sort of becoming the progressive alternative was where the momentum was going to fall.
Right.
A lot of effort went into establishing that early momentum as between the Liberal and NDP. I think that's probably why we had a fairly quick start. We got the offices set up. The signs were ordered. So the minute we could put them out, they were there.
Right.
That was somebody's big idea was we need to show on day one we're ready to go. And
that you were the alternative to us.
That's right. And it's funny. Like, I don't know that I would have remembered it, but now that you say it, that was a very deliberate part of the campaign strategy that the team developed at the time.
Right.
And
smart.
No, it was good. And I forget who on the team came up with it. It wasn't me personally. But when somebody pitched it, I'm like, that makes sense to me. So.
Right.
We went for it.
It's funny with the momentum. I remember very distinctly driving through James Street in Antigonish. You had one of your campaign offices there. And it was just a quiet, normal Tuesday evening in the summer. And you had about 30 friggin' people out there with red shirts on, working in the office and outside. And I was like, holy frig, what's going on here? This is not a good sign.
No, well, it's a funny thing because I grew up not actively engaged in a lot of campaigns, but my dad ran once provincially growing up, and my mom made him more or less. But my mom's been sort of a volunteer with the Liberal Party for as long as I can remember. But their campaigns used to be four or five people would sit and drink coffee and talk about politics and occasionally.
Not unlike a lot of conservative campaigns, though. Though we won a lot of elections there, there wasn't a lot of actual campaigning happening.
Yeah, and we had a couple folks who had worked professionally in politics, two guys in particular, David Shepherd and Mike Mercer, who showed up on the ground, and they had run a number of campaigns between them.
Okay.
And they kind of ingrained in us, there's actually a way people have learned how to do this.
Yeah.
And if you don't do it, you're not going to win.
Right.
If you do it, you might. And we bought into the idea that we should take advice from people who'd been involved with a winning campaign before. And it was kind of a neat thing because once we started to act like professionals, we attracted other people who wanted to be part of it. And without that sort of kick in the pants with a few people who'd done it before, there wouldn't have been 30 people working the phones out in the Antigonish office on James Street.
Right. From the conservative perspective, again, where it was a safe seat in our eyes, it was very different because I've campaigned across the country in many local and national levels. It was hard to get people to buy into that because they didn't have to do it before. So actually doing door knocking and stuff had never really been done. The previous candidates would just go and basically just visit well-known Tories in different communities, and that would be their campaigning day, and do a few media hits.
Yeah, I was visiting well-known Tories as well.
And
actually, Bryson came down with us for a couple days in Antigonish, and he's like, "We're gonna try a few things." And we started visiting a handful of folks who knew him when he was a progressive conservative.
Right.
And I didn't realize at the time, but he was testing the waters to see if we get one or two of these folks, you're going to be fine. I'm going to spend my time elsewhere.
Right.
But it was interesting because I don't think most of them were coming our way, but most of them weren't going to work too hard against us, and it felt good.
Funny talk about Bryson and Anakinish. He told me a funny joke once. It was after there was a big flood in Anakinish in 99. There was a storm that got caught in the mountains, and it kept just regenerating itself. And a lot of houses, my parents' house included, got significant damage. And this was right after a week or two after the 99 election that the Conservatives won the provincial government. And Scott would tell the joke that, liberals in Anakinish. Now, this is back when he was a Conservative.
Yeah.
Liberals in Anakinish were saying that's God's punishment for voting Conservative in that riding. And then he'd say, no, it's actually just liberal tears that caused it all. So,
yeah, he's not short on jokes, but most of them I can't repeat on your show.
Right. Well, I'm sure you can, but I hear you. So how did you find the media coverage throughout the campaign? I felt it tough. There was a lot of, when you're in government, you know exactly what I'm talking about now. We were in government 9 years, and it felt like we were just playing defense the whole time. And it was tough to get any kind of stories through. We made some really dumb changes to employment insurance that didn't at all fix anything, but it didn't change anything. All it did was make people feel like we were against them. I'm not sure if you remember that issue well back then, but it was like one of these things. So how did you feel then how it was for you guys, though?
Yeah, well, look, I actually do remember the issue because it wasn't long after we unveiled some of the changes we wanted to make to EI, which were very well received with seasonal industries in Atlantic Canada as well. And I have no doubt, though I wasn't involved at the time, that they were watching what one side was doing and tailoring the response to take advantage of the opportunity. But at the time, media coverage for me and for the group at home was new. The idea that anybody was watching us at all was a novelty. Right. And we felt very flattered by it. We were like, they actually want to hear our perspective. They must think we could win. And I remember my first interview. It was a very basic interview. It was kind of get to know you. It was Carol at the news. She's since left. Everybody's left. from the news in New Glasgow, and it was just they did the Q&A with all of the with all the candidates, and we realized that there was an appetite for what we had to say. And to your point about coming in from third party status, no less, not just a new candidate, third party status. Nobody at the beginning was taking us seriously. The polls were bad. It seemed as though people were willing to project onto us whatever they wanted to see in an alternative.
Right.
And it created an opportunity. And that doesn't mean you have to fake who you are at all. You just go and talk about the things that you want to achieve. But people don't have tough questions about the things that you didn't do already because it wasn't your job.
Right.
They didn't hold you to account for decisions somebody else took. Even if you might have agreed with them, they tended not to ask you about it. They wanted to know, what do you want to do? And if the question is put to you, not what's wrong with this position or that position, but tell me a good thing you want to do, people are usually quite happy to hear the answer because it's generally a positive answer. But I found the media coverage at the time was more of a platform to get to know the candidate than it was really pinning us down on tough questions, which in retrospect, of course, that's a political advantage. But it's since then, the capacity of local news to really dig in and put those tougher questions is diminished. And I think it's something I'm worried about, frankly, in the years ahead.
It is something, right? Like salt wire now collapsing around us, too. There's a lot of media, local media in the Maritimes especially, that's just disappearing. Now social media is the way, direct messaging, but then you're talking to your own people all the time, right? It's hard to grow and maybe get to a neutral message. It was interesting for me, the media coverage. I remember, just to go back to the nomination, I was nominated on Saturday, you were nominated on Sunday. I came from Ottawa, you came from Calgary. We're both from Central Nova, that's home to us, but we both were coming back. And the Herald write-up on us on Monday was Ottawa parachute Fred DeLory versus Pictou County lawyer Sean Fraser. I was like, what the hell is that?
So
how did you get that?
Yeah,
and I'm the parachute.
I know. It's funny because I remember at the time, Ross, the NDP candidate who was a provincial minister, our campaign caught wind of a rumor that he was going to confront us at a debate by producing a Nova Scotia driver's license, seeing he was the only one who could do that. I actually went and changed my driver's license. I'm moving home. I adopted the mindset. I got my new ID card, my new license. I was set up. I had my health card still in my wallet from Nova Scotia because I never changed it over. And I was ready to go, and then he never ended up pulling that particular line. But we were ready for it anyway.
Well, I'm glad you didn't, because I still had my Ontario one. Not that it would have changed the results, but I would have been more embarrassed. So that's funny. On that point, though, he was going aggressively against us as basically come from a ways or parachutes, Ross was. And I remember the great line you delivered at the St. of X debate when he was talking about it there, about how we were, you know, we left the province. And you made the beautiful point about how you were a young lawyer looking for work, and you called your MLA, who was the Attorney General at the time of the province, who never returned your call. It was Ross Landry.
It was.
That took the house down.
I had expected, as you could probably tell from the response, that it was going to come up. I could not have dreamed up a scenario where he gave his closing remarks and I followed without a chance to rebut. There was a couple meetings canceled, and I had something along the lines of, so Ross, I'm glad we're having our meeting. I'm glad it's tonight. I'm glad it's in front of everybody at home. And in all honesty, the main reason that I was, there's a number of things that I've always cared about. The main reason I ran in 2015, as you'll know, being from home, like everybody moved away for work or somebody in the family did. I got five sisters, all of them, with one exception, was working away from home. I was working away from home. Everybody I knew left home. Yeah. And it was the main thing I wanted to change. And I thought if I actually dedicated myself to creating opportunities for young people to stay, it's something that's worth signing up for this crazy life for. But to have it fall out in a public debate the way it did was something I couldn't have written myself if I tried for 100 years.
No, it was good. And the crowd erupted.
You leaned over and said, how long have you been hanging on to that one?
It was powerful. And obviously, I wish I had an opportunity to deliver something like that. But it was good. And on that front, we did a lot of debates. And it's funny, as a campaign manager, I always, and as a conservative at that front, we always tell candidates, and with good reason, they should just do one debate at most. It's usually very few people in the room. Most of them are partisans who know who they're voting for. And it's just funny to me, and how many national campaigns I've worked on where I was really the person who pushed that message. And then in Central Nova, I'm the candidate, and I just say, f*** it, and I go and do a ton of debates with you. It's funny how when you're a candidate, you really sometimes lose discipline, like I did.
Yeah, well, look, it's different, too, because what may work in one part of the country may not in another. And in our riding at home, like, we must have had six or seven debates.
Yeah,
and
very localized, right, because of all the different regions of the riding.
And I remember we had, in the subsequent campaign, I remember George Kenyon was the candidate, and he was on tour for the first few weeks of the campaign, and he actually missed a couple debates. And though there was 40 people maybe in the room at Sheet Harbor, it spread through the community that one of the candidates didn't come to the debate for the next few weeks, even after he was on the ground. And a real nice guy, by the way. But it's a funny thing where if you go up, it's not that there's a huge opportunity, but if you fail to show,
it spreads. No, I did miss one in Marigamish or Arisaig, your neck of the woods, early on in the campaign. I had a conflict. I missed one, and I heard about it for the rest of the next 70 some days of that campaign.
Yeah, I
bet.
People
kept bringing it up. So it is something that, in certain ridings, it does have a different feel. So when did you feel, like, how was your, like, going through this election? I felt it was a roller coaster for me, whether I could win or not. During the nomination, it was tough. What stressed me the most was the nomination. I felt that was the toughest part. Obviously, I won that and lost the election, but it was the nomination that stressed me, because that's that internal battle. Am I welcomed amongst my own fellow conservatives type thing? And I was able to win that. And then going into the general, my confidence was really shaken the Friday night of my nomination. So we had a nomination. We had a Friday night vote and a Saturday vote, different parts of the riding. Right before my vote Friday, one of my campaign members called me and said, okay, whatever you do in your speech tonight, which is just a Conservative Party members, closed room, only party members, This person said to me, whatever you do, don't mention Stephen Harper. And I was like, okay, that's a bad sign when our leader and prime minister and conservatives are worried that he's a drag on our ballot. How did you feel throughout all of this in terms of the up and down? I mean, it's easy for you to look back at this and, you know, you're always doing well and always just, but did you feel you're going to lose at different points or?
So at the beginning, like we were pulling in a distant third when we, when I moved home and started campaigning, and we were placing on a bet on the idea that, look, A, this is worth doing because if you don't do it, you're never going to have a chance. B, there was a real sense in talking to people, not backed by any data whatsoever, pure anecdote, that this is going to break against the incumbent government and whoever the alternative is going to win. It's actually funny you mentioned one of those polls because I think it was the day of the Annie Ganish debate, I was like walking up on the stage. The National Post, I forget which outfit ran the poll, Main Street maybe. Mm-hmm. It had you up. We were a bit back, but
6 points back. It was September 21st, Main Street had
right on.
I was at 36, you were 30.
Yeah, so and the NDP were like half a dozen points behind
they
4 points.
Yeah,
we had far back. A measurable but small difference. And that was the moment I felt I was going to win, and we never looked back.
Right.
And the reason why the undecided in that poll was ballpark 24, 25%, something like that. Like, it was significant.
Yes, yeah.
And when I had been out knocking doors, the number one thing we heard from undecided voters was, we don't know who we're supporting, but it's who's ever going to beat Harper.
Right.
So I was looking at that 24%, and I felt like I had 20 of them. And so I did the math real quick. That's not far off from where the ball ended up at the end of the day. So my campaign manager came up to me and he's like, we've been trying not to show you this poll. Like, are you okay? And I said, are you kidding me? This is the best thing I could imagine. Our volunteers are going to be motivated like hell. We had a sign up at our office that said 100 votes behind. That's sort of the mentality that we wanted everybody to adopt. So they went to the debate, felt energized, wanted to start working the phones that night. We had to be like, you can't call people after 9 p.m. And the team was motivated. I was in a place where I was pretty confident we were going to have it. And from that point on, we felt pretty good. There were days where something went wrong. Somebody said something in the news that was negative, and for the first time as a candidate, that can shake your confidence.
Yeah.
It was that moment, and then a few weeks later, I had some bad morning. I don't know if Frank Magazine ran something, whatever it was. And my campaign manager could tell I wasn't feeling great for the first time during the campaign, and he said, "You think it's going to be close?" I said, I think we can get it close. We're going to be tight in Pictou County. I think we've been putting time in on the Eastern Shore. Andy Ganish is going to be for us. And he said, it's not going to be close. and I said, you bastard. Do you have polling? He said, you're up 27 points. I'm like, come on.
Now, I will say it was the closest conservative seat in the province in terms of, you know, I came the closest winning of any conservative. But yeah, you crushed me.
Look, the real political attribute that I have is timing. It's through my career, there's been a number of things that have broken the right way for me in successive elections. But in 2015, in retrospect, there was a big red wave that swept through Atlantic Canada, 32 for 32. That has never happened. In 93. One of the two seats the PCs held on was in Atlantic Canada.
Right.
So this is not something that I can say, look, this was a hard-fought victory that I earned personally. We had a great team nationally. We had a great team on the ground. But we didn't know that until we were three-quarters of the way into the campaign.
Right. But then you learned from it and got the confidence to help to know how to run the next two campaigns that you guys did, right?
Yeah, that's right. And boy, did we ever learn. And it's great. The team makes calls between election cycles now. It's I know Roger Kuzner, during my first re-election, Roger became a bit of a mentor to me up here and really helped me focus on stay connected to home, but don't feel you got to chase every single issue up in Ottawa. Pick the things that are going to make a difference. And I asked him for advice going into that next election. And he said, look, it's probably written at this stage. It's not what you eat between Christmas and New Year's that keeps you healthy. It's what you eat between New Year's and Christmas. And he said, you've been doing your job for 4 years. The campaign will matter, but I think you're going to do just fine. And it's because we keep that organization going that that I think will stand a chance in future elections as well.
Mm-hmm. So for me, that poll on the Main Street poll that had me up, it was the opposite reaction where I was like, oh, this is bad. You're right on my heels. And all you need is the collapse of the NDP, which is likely happens every election, right? The NDP collapses into the Liberal vote, and we were only 6 points back. So then it was like, it was demoralizing. It was hard, like, going into it. And then, you know, obviously knocking on doors. And I remember as in McClellan Drive in Antigonish, knocking on doors on a Friday evening at like 5 o'clock or 5:30 when Steve Murphy came on. And I could hear in the background, this is day 14 of the Mike Duffy trial. I was like, oh God, like having a criminal trial during an election. I wish we could have tried to avoid that.
Yes. Sometimes the courts don't operate on your schedule.
Yeah. But when you know, when the court is, maybe you can do an election at a different time. So let's go to election night. Where were you watching results? Were you at your headquarters all night?
No, I was at my wife's house. My wife grew up in the community as well in New Glasgow. I was sort of in between New Glasgow and Antigonish. And her mom's place is 5 minutes from... We booked out Glasgow Square for the for the event that night. And we watched it from 5 minute drive away. So we wouldn't be there, but could show up quickly afterward. I still remember when the projection came on a little bit earlier than we thought, and everybody sort of shouted with joy, and my nephew at the time, who was just barely walking, just scared the hell out of him, and he fell over weeping for the rest of the night while everybody else was jazzed. But he had Pictou County pizza on order, a bunch of keys on hand, and then we went down to celebrate at Glasgow Square. It was cool.
Right. So I, different story.
I remember.
So I was, my wife and I were at our place. We were about 10 minutes out from my headquarters in New Glasgow as well. And my wife had run in Ontario a number of years before, and it was a back and forth campaign all night, like the results. It was just ping pong ball. CTB actually declared her the winner at one point for eventually to not win.
Wow.
So that was my experience on the personal level. So I was like, okay, let's see if this was how this was going to go. So we put the kids to bed because we had three young kids at the time, four now. Put them to bed. My wife is just getting ready to go to headquarters. I'm just going to polls close, watching TV, watching the results come in. As soon as the polls closed, about 5-10 minutes later, Janet Friday-Dory, who was the regional organizer at the time, then most recently is executive director of the party, calls me up and says, we just got the poll results for Hopewell. Now, Hopewell was the best conservative poll in perhaps the province of Nova Scotia. And we lost by about 80 votes. So I was like, all right, I'll get the kids up. We're heading in to concede. And we went in right away, and it was lots of media there. Because I think that at this point, it had boiled down to maybe the Conservatives could win one seat in the Maritimes, and it was Central Novas that they were looking at, or at least in Nova Scotia. So lots of media did my concession and said I'd keep a close eye on you and if you'd fix all the roads and all the stuff that we kept hearing about. It's funny how much jurisdictions got mixed up, eh? And everyone was...
They still do.
They still do. Conceded. And then I remember coming down the stairs and Peter was there, Peter McKay, and my wife and I were talking and he was stunned at the blowout, right? You didn't just win. You crushed us by, I think, 13,000 votes or so. And again, that was the closest race in the province because, again, Central Nova is traditionally a very blue seat. So there was still some leftover vote there. But I remember Peter, like, just stunned saying, like, I would have lost this. And that was, like, that hit. Like, holy fuck. Like, this is a wipeout. And then I, you know, had worked in Ottawa for so long and seeing the whole red wave go across the country, it was tough. And then it was funny. I jumped in a car. Carla McFarlane, the MLA for Pictou West, who just announced
she's
leaving
dear friend
provincial
of mine.
Politics.
Yeah, I wish her well.
She's a Speaker of the House, I guess, technically, or she has resigned from that. I don't know. Pat Dunn, Tim Houston, now Premier, and Peter and I all piled into a car and went over to your headquarters. And that was one of the things to concede the election and to shake your hand and congratulate you. I've been in a lot of campaigns, and what I appreciated the most is that I the end of it, I didn't hate you. I didn't have a grudge against you. I wasn't like, there was no bitterness between us. And you know, maybe the big blowout helped that. It wasn't like you won by 500, which I may have lost a lot of sleep over for a lot of months, but it's easy to get over when it's a wave hits you.
Yeah. And look, one of the other things that I think is, increasingly rare in politics is a sense of civility between competitors. Like we're both from home. I find people in the Maritimes are for the most part still pretty good to disagree with their friends in a way that doesn't right. interfere with the relationship. Like growing up, my exposure to politics, I didn't realize it was at the time, wasn't necessarily partisan in nature, but mom and dad had everybody at home was conservative, except my family, it seemed.
Right.
And we had a few on the shore road that would break our way on a given election cycle. But people come around the kitchen table and they'd talk politics and people'd say, oh, you're right about this, you're wrong about that. And at the end of it, they'd all help put the dishes away and pour a cup of tea or crack a beer and talk about something else. And it was no sweat. Right. I feel like that's, at least I still hope that that's what the culture is like at home. And I really do fear that sometimes the way we've come to consume politics in recent years is shifting people's perspective. We're fed information that we're prone to agree with, and it confirms our biases instead of challenging our perspectives. And it's just not like it was at home. And I find when I still go into Tim's check-in with the people solving the world's problems in the morning, it's more like
A&W, you mean?
Yeah, that A&W too. Yeah, it's fourth best restaurant according to TripAdvisor in Pictou County. I do think you... if you can divorce yourself from the comments on Twitter, you'll find most people still crave that. And I found that was the way during our debates. Even if you'd stick one on me, I never felt it was personal.
I don't think I got many over on you, though.
Well, the crowds weren't recall. Breaking your way, Fred. No, I'm not going to lie.
Certainly weren't. A few swings and misses there. Yeah, no, it's true. It's a. It was a. Even our teams, like. I got to campaign with some great people, right? Like the MLAs that I mentioned earlier, and their teams, right? So a lot of the way it worked there, to build our team quickly, I really leaned on a lot of the provincial ridings. We had a lot of MLAs, mm-hmm. Tim, Pat, and Carla, especially, and they were, you know, wonderful people. And I got to, you know, almost become like family with some of them, and just how great they were. And they all knew, like, you know, their buddies would be working on the Liberal team. Like, it's all a whole different type.
Totally. And I'm thinking the names that you're mentioning, like Pat taught with my mom for years and years.
Right.
Carla has become a great friend who I've just got endless respect for. Tim and I work closely together now, him as premier, me as a federal minister. And we've always had a mutual respect and understanding. We're both trying to help the community. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my pals are involved with the Conservative Party. A lot of their staff are friends with my staff. It's just I hope that people see there's more of that in the world than they think.
Right. Okay. So after the election now, you've now our paths diverged quickly here. I'm no longer running again, of course. And you go into, were you a parliamentary secretary right away?
Or no, the first, I was probably 2.5 years as a backbench MP doing the committee work before I was, would have been summer 2018. I was made PS to Catherine McKenna on the environment portfolio.
Right. Remember that. Right. And then so was immigration your first cabinet ministry?
That's right.
Okay. You did that for how long?
Almost a couple of years. So that would have been October 2021, and then it was July 2023. I got moved to the current gig.
So for me, I went 6 months without a paycheck, come back to Ottawa. You guys have wiped out, you've taken government. All my Tory friends are wiped out and gone. This town's turned into a red town. It was a strange time, right? I had so many friends on the employment line. So I didn't know what I was going to do. Politics is something I've done my whole life. So I decided to, communications is also what I've done. So I went in and started my own firm doing media training, for MPs and senators and speech writing, and then evolved into what everyone evolves into at some point in their lives, government relations, and did that. And then I never thought I'd work in politics again. And then Aaron O'Toole called me and asked me to run his national leadership campaign in 2017. 16, he called me, and 17 was the race. So I got sucked back in and realized how much I love politics and how much it is important to me and who I am in so many ways. And then got to work on and run Christine Elliott's leadership campaign, in which we got 52% of the vote and lost to Doug Ford, which was a tough one. But then worked on Premier Ford's election campaign, which was a great experience too. And then, of course, worked on Aaron's comeback in 2020. So we've taken different paths. We're both heavily involved still. Of course, my biggest thing right now is hosting On Background here at iPolitics, and you're building houses across the country by the looks of it. How's that going?
Look, it can never happen fast enough. We're in a real challenging position when it comes to housing in Canada, and it's you know, it's almost better to come into a role like this when everyone knows there's a real crisis situation because. They look to you to try new things. People won't necessarily hold you personally accountable for the position that you're in if you've been put into it at a time when, particularly after the pandemic, a lot of the housing stock was bought up in this country. The rate of interest has made it difficult to build, and people see that this is an immense challenge. And if they see you're putting in serious effort, I think people will give you the benefit of the doubt that you're really trying to make a difference. And my sense is the policy track that we've been able to put ourselves on is much stronger than we were on before. But there's a long way to go before I'm going to be able to say, hey, we've solved the housing crisis. It's look, talk to a young person today who can't afford a place to live. Talk to somebody who's not thinking about buying a home, but keeping the place that they're renting now. It's certainly young people, but like seniors who are trying to downsize in the community where their grandkids are being raised. It's like very human right. In terms of what people are dealing with. But look, my sense is we've got buy-in within government and an appetite with the Canadian public to do big things right now on this file. And over the next couple of days, in fact, we're going to have more to say about the path forward,
right.
And have been releasing some of the portions of the plan over the last week and a half or so. But it's time to make a big bet on housing if we're going to not just solve that problem, but maximize the potential of the Canadian economy.
So on the political side of things, one of my big criticisms of the Liberals has been communications and how they communicate and what messages you guys push out and how you do it. And I do have to commend you. I think you're one of the few that seem to be able to tell a story. The rest of your, and I'm not, you're obviously not going to shit on your colleagues here, and I don't expect you to. You're going to defend them and do your thing. But I find a big thing that's missing from the Liberals is an overarching narrative on what they're doing. If you go back to conservative success in campaigns, we had the Canada's Economic Action Plan in 2011, like a full encompassing plan that we were able to push. In 21, when you guys called an early election that you guys were going to storm and get a majority government, we came out quickly with Canada's recovery plan, and we basically kept the results almost similar to what they were previous election. Right now, though, I don't know what the Liberal overarching thing is, and maybe we'll see when the budget comes out if that's presented there. But I will commend you. I do think you're going out there and fighting the good fight, but it feels like you're alone a lot of the time.
Look, I think when it comes to political communication, the danger that incumbent governments run into, I catch myself even in conversations with my team or with colleagues by times, of thinking about what you read in the most recent briefing note and the antidote for it.
That's the most important thing.
Totally. And I think you can't fall victim to government-itis. And the antidote for it is to show up at A&W or Tim Hortons or talk to people at the farmer's market and just remain plugged into what people are motivated by. And there's a lot of anxiety right now across Canada and communities in every part of the country. You go across Canada, overwhelmingly, you'll hear about the same issues. Affordability, top of the list.
Yep.
Housing, right next to it. The environment's still a priority, but people want to make sure that they're able to manage the costs of what they think is the right thing to do to transition to a healthier environment. They want good jobs, and they want to make sure they have access to a doctor and quality health care. Like those five things over and over and over. There are other issues that come up, but the consistent pattern around those particular issues is just it's overwhelming to me how consistently people are feeling the same things in different parts of the country.
Right.
And a lot of them are tied to things people have always cared about, but a lot of them have been impacted uniquely by this post-pandemic phase where the world's trying to figure out what the new normal looks like. And I think if we just remain connected on the fact that people are worried about, are they going to have a pension when they retire? Can they afford a home? Can they take a job based on the opportunity rather than what the rent's going to cost in that city? And I find if we actually go back to our roots, whether it's the vision statement for the Liberal Party of Canada around building a prosperous, socially just, and environmentally healthy Canada, or if it's the horse we rode in 2015, supporting the middle class and those working hard to join it, we should be able to tie it back to what people are really feeling. But look, working people need a break. Middle class families feel like life is too expensive. They want to do the right thing for the planet and for their community, but they want to make sure they're taking care of themselves and their family at the same time. I don't think that's too much to ask. And I think if we spend more and more time talking to people in their own communities and not trying to treat affordability like something we read about in a book, we'll be much better served when it comes to communications.
Right, right. And we're seeing signs of that. We're seeing all of, in terms of better communication, in terms of the rollout of the pre-budget stuff. Like it's fascinating to see. You know, we've always talked about, you always see two or three items come out. I find the Liberals the last while haven't done much, but we used to do a couple of items. Liberals sometimes would do a couple of items, but you guys have like 2 weeks, seems like a 2 week runway or a week and a half runway of stuff. So you're really getting stuff out instead of dropping it all one day and everything's just forgotten.
Yeah, and look, it's a new approach and I think a better one. I'll be interested to see if in future years we or in the very distant future some other government may end up doing it a similar way. The reason that you typically have a budget drop once, and the convention around budget secrecy is protected as this sacrosanct value, is that you don't want to divulge market-moving information in a way that would distort the economy or create pervert the results of decisions that people may make in the world. But if you realize you share it publicly at the same time for everybody, you avoid that consequence, and tradition for the sake of tradition is not that important in this yeah. regard. But if you drop 218 new funding decisions on the same day, the association of this or that will know about the thing that impacts them, but nobody in your community
right.
will. I get a kick out of it. Some of us, when we were brand new, sending out those householders to people across Canada in our respective ridings, we'd list after our first year in office every community center that got like $1,200 for
right.
replacing the window or the
right.
$10,000 for the to make the entry more accessible, whatever it might be. But if you include like 38 different things, guess how many people remember? Absolutely zero.
Right.
But the strategy this time around is saying, you know what, we're going to pick a thing each day. We're going to try to make sure that we communicate it to people in a way that makes sense, speaks to things they actually care about, and we don't crowd the airspace with so many things that they miss at all. And my sense is, it's too early to tell, but my sense is it's breaking through, certainly with the chattering classes who watch these things. But I'm hearing a lot more at home. I was at the hardware store doing a couple things just around the small stuff at the house. And somebody came up and just said, thrilled with the National School Food Program. I think if we dropped that on the same budget day, I don't know that person would have heard about it. And it's a new
they
approach.
They wouldn't have. No, they yeah. wouldn't have. There's no
yeah.
question.
Yeah. So, I'm pleased with the rollout to date. And we'll still have work to do on the back end of the budget. But as importantly as communicating the right way is having the right stuff to communicate. You can screw up comms on good policy. You can't communicate bad policy well.
Right. No, 100%. 100% agree. Look, next year is the next election, 2025. It's 10-year anniversary of your first election, which was against me. What do you think? Should we do Frasier versus DeLorey part two?
Yeah, well, look, your timing wouldn't be as challenging this time around. I still think
nice
we get
a blue wave, maybe.
Yeah, look, I think we're going to be very competitive on our part at home. I think you'd be a stellar candidate, but. You know what? I'm still going to launch the carpetbagger parachute candidate lines against you, but I'll make you produce that driver's license. Change it now.
I really like the seat I'm in right now here in the iPolitics studio. So I can assure you and my wife and family who are listening that I will not be doing that.
Yeah.
But thanks so much for coming in. This was a really fun chat.
No, pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much, Fred. And best of luck. Hope to see you around home, but not as my opposing candidate.
All right, folks, thanks so much for listening to On Background. This was a really fun chat. Don't forget to subscribe and share this to friends, and tune in next week when we come to you with a brand new episode of On Background.